Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our series of conversations with remarkable minds, the theme, the pervading myth in Western civilization of human supremacy and its consequences on the environment and climate change. I have two guests today. The first is Derek Jensen from Northern California. Derek has become one of the nation's leading voices of cultural and environmental dissent. He writes about civilization's devastating impact upon the environment and the natural world and our society's denial of that fact. Hutney Reader listed Derek among the 50 visionaries changing the world. In sharp contrast to environmental optimists who believe working within the corporate system will offset the tenuous planetary balance threatening our climate, Derek has advocated for many years of a dismantling of civilization, which can include radical dissent as well as imparting wisdom to our children. Derek has written many books on these themes, including The Myth of Human Supremacy, and it may be one of the more important of his works. His radio program called Resistance Radio is on the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. His website is derekjensen.com, or .org. That's D-E-R-R-I-C-K-J-E-N-S-E-N. He'll be joined about halfway through the program from Ontario, Canada, by Diane Burchford Kroger. She's an Irish-Canadian researcher, she's a scientist, and she's a natural mystic who perhaps knows more about trees and forests than anyone in North America. She's an expert botanist and medical biochemist. She's written extensively on the molecular biology of trees, their medicinal properties, the social interaction between trees and other life forms in our forest, and sustainable forestry, and the traditional wisdom trees hold for healing. Her scientific work has appeared in the American Heart Journal, in the Journal of Microscopy. In the past, she has held science posts at the Canadian Department of Agriculture, University of Ottawa School of Medicine, and her research gardens outside of Ottawa, which are open to the public, include rare plants from Turkey, Iran, China, and 100 rare types of trees from northern forests in other countries. Her latest book, The Sweetness of a Simple Life, and a documentary on Diane's work across many nations to restore forests called The Call of the Forest, scheduled to be released in the fall. And her website, I'll spell it for you, is Diana, D-I-A-N-A, Burchford, B-E-R-E-S-F-O-R-D, dash Kroger, K-R-O-E-G-E-R, dot H-T-M-L. Let's begin with Derek. Nice to have you with us today, Derek.
Thanks so much for having me, and thank you for all your work.
Derek, we're going to focus on a myth that is ingrained into the DNA of our modern civilization and that is largely unknown or at best ignored or denied by the majority of people living in industrial and technological societies. In many respects, it is a myth that underlies the entire capitalist agenda of infinite progress, infinite growth, unlimited growth and development. And yet it is also a myth that is found embedded in the major religions that have had an explicit role in the creation of capitalism, such as the 18th century economist Adam Smith's metaphor of the capitalist marketplace as the invisible hand of God. And that myth is that within the natural world, many people believe this, by the way, among the billions of organisms and animals and plants and microbes, humans rank supreme. It is the myth of human supremacy. And as we deconstruct this myth and investigate its underlying principles and motives and its closed-mindedness to any other concept that anything in the natural world has innate intelligence equal to its own, we will also show you the consequences of people who believe in our supremacy, because when people believe that we are supreme, then they believe in a manifest destiny. Because they are supreme, whatever they think, whatever they do, must be guided by some invisible hand of God. Think of all the different conquests of peoples, of nations. Think of also in those cultures that have held women subordinate to men, the supremacy of the male ego, which is shown in many religious texts, in many religions, in our social orders throughout the world. We should not confuse that with people adapting over many generations to their role and then no longer wanting to view themselves as equal or as unique, but rather subservient to. And this can come to whole populations. But behind this is also this madness that their thoughts will pervade everything. And I believe personally that it's that kind of mindset that is driving humanity towards its own annihilation. I'll give you just one example to set this in motion. We have been working for more than 8 years on a major documentary and a major book on the environment. It's called The Tipping Points. And in here, we're only using the finest quality science showing that there are certain areas of the world that are simply not going to be sustainable for life. Now, that doesn't mean someone couldn't live there. It doesn't mean everyone would have to leave, but it means that the number of people, for example, in Southern California, in Utah, in Colorado, in Kansas, in most of Texas, in Nevada, that there simply will not be an opportunity for them to enjoy the life that many people in the past have had. They're running out of water. They're already out of water. 6.5 million people currently living in the state of Texas and over 1,400 communities lack the amount of water they require just to have a sustainable life. So we adapt to that. Other people are living on the beaches or, let's say, from Key West to at least up through Savannah. You probably have between 20 and 30,000 homes and high-rises. It's not sustainable. It will be taken away by the ocean, just a matter of when. You have people living where there's a massive amount of dryness and hence fires. Other people in earthquake areas and some in tornado areas. And yet, ask any of these people, have you looked at anything other than the quality of your life and the value of your investment? Have you looked at, is this sustainable? And they look at you with a puzzled stare. What do you mean? And they have taken out of all the equations of where to live, where to buy, what to eat, the idea that if it's not sustainable, then shouldn't you get with what is? And so this is something we're seeing right now. The people we vote for office, vote into office, who have the power, they're creating systems of governance that are not sustainable to a democracy or a republic, which we were supposed to be. So that said, please take your time and go through your observations about how all this sense of uniqueness, sense of supremacy, is impacting us. The forum is yours.
Well, I think you've laid it out, you know, really clearly. And you know, I keep thinking about something I read maybe 30 years ago, which is that unquestioned beliefs are the real authorities of any culture. And these are how we get through the day. I'm going to go a different direction for a second, too, that there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And if when you look at this individual tree, you see this individual tree, you'll treat it differently still. The same, it's, to go a different direction again, so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that, for the most part, we Westerners perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited, as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And this affects every part of our interactions. And I think about this every time I go to write, because when I type something into a word processing program, if I write the tree who stands over there, the word processing program will attempt to correct that to the tree that. And So on every level from, and that was a discussion I had with the publishers, you know, I turned in the manuscript, and one of the things that the publisher said is, well, the first actually thing he said when we started to edit the book is, we need to have the who that discussion. And because he wanted to switch everything from all my references to the bacteria who, the tree who, the river who, to the bacteria that, the tree that, the river that. And of course I didn't do that. But the point is that that's how deeply this notion that non-humans are not sentient, they don't have lives that are just as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. That's how deeply this affects us. When it gets down to the level of grammar, then it is pretty much the definition of an unquestioned assumption. And we can also look at this that, well, so let's say that you were talking to people on a bus or talking to people in the halls of Congress, and you said, you know, prairie dogs have just as much right to live as human beings do. Or if you said that, you know, mushrooms are just as intelligent as we are, you would get laughed out of the place. And that's part of the problem. And the problem is not just there, but this leads to something that's even deeper, which is, I think that we as a culture, I'm not talking about us as individuals, we as a culture perceive the point of life, that life to be like a game of Risk, where the point is to run your armies all over the board and take over the whole board and then you win, or like Monopoly, where you drive everybody out and you end up controlling all the land. That's clearly how empires work. You know, there's the British Empire is pushing everybody around and trying to take as much land as possible, and there's the, you know, American Empire and the Russian Empire, and there's all these empires, the French Empire, Spanish Empire, there's all these empires that are trying to do this. And let's contrast that with another way to be, where the point of life is not to become the only one who exists, but instead to, the point of life is this wonderful symphony, and the point of life is to figure out your proper role and to play at the proper time. So instead of the violin players trying to kill all the oboe players and take their seats, instead we're seeing what sort of music we can all make together. And this affects us in so many ways that I'm gonna back off in a second, but I want to address this for a second, that plants, there's a great line that somebody said to me about 20 years ago about how the scientific measurement, the ability of science to measure things is getting to be so great that it's only so long that they'll be able to maintain the facade that only humans communicate. And this is not a bow to the greatness of science, because I've got real problems with a lot of science, but the point is that our measurements are the ability to measure what others are doing is becoming so clear that we can no longer ignore the communications that are going on all the time. And a great example of this is plants, that if a caterpillar comes and starts to eat a leaf, that that plant will, if it's some species, well, at least, will send off messages. It will change the composition of its own leaves to make them less palatable or more toxic to the caterpillars, and then at the same time it will send out messages to other plants to tell them, hey, there's a certain species of caterpillar here, change the composition of your leaves so that the caterpillars don't like them. And here's an example of how the belief that life is based on this ruthless competition infects everything. There were some scientists who actually studied this who then were asking this question, why would a plant waste energy, this is almost a direct quote, why would a plant waste energy cooing in its competitors about, you know, helping its competitors to survive? And my answer to that is because they recognize that life is not actually a competition, and they recognize that a redwood forest does not consist only of redwood trees, but also cedar trees, alder trees, cascaras, you know, salal, huckleberry. They recognize that everybody has a role to play, and let's change one word. And instead of asking why would they help their competitors to survive, why don't we ask why would they help their neighbors to survive? And that word changes everything. And that's one of the problems with this whole supremacist mindset, is it leads us to always be perceiving everyone else as a competitor and to trying to outcompete. And this goes to, I've seen many definitions of biological success being basically based on how many of you are there. And that's a completely wrong definition of biological success. A better definition of biological success is, how well do you improve the capacity of the land to support your own life and to support the lives of others? How healthy do you make the land base? And because the land is the source of all life, and that's a much more relevant long-term measure of ecological success. So my point really quickly in this, and I guess I'll go another direction now, my point really quickly so far is just that the this notion of supremacy, the notion of everything being based on competition, affects every aspect of our lives. And then the next thing I want to say is that much of the book, or parts of the book at least, are, I go through all the examples, or many examples, of ways that we always consider ourselves to be superior, and I show that all these ways are sort of moving goalposts where we say, oh, we're superior because of this, and then when it's shown that that's not, we're not unique in that way, it's like, well, shoot, we got to come up with another way. And a great example of that is we always hear that humans are really special, and intelligence is based on the fact that we have really big brains. Well, it ends up that we don't, our brains are not particularly bigger than everybody else's. I mean, ours are about, I think, 2.5 pounds, and walruses are slightly smaller. Elephants, of course, are much bigger. Whales are much bigger. Some people say, oh my gosh, well then, it's obviously not the size of your brain that's important. What's important is your brain size to body mass ratio. Well, the problem with that is humans are about 4-pound brain, that's right. So anyway, the human brain size to body mass ratio is about 2.5%. Our brains are about 2.5% of our body weight. And unfortunately for us, that's the same as it is for mice. And songbirds have about 8%, and shrews have about 10%. They're among the biggest. And so my point is, what happens then is they go, oh, well, gosh, obviously brain size to body mass ratio isn't what's important. And they come up with something else, and then something else, and then something else. It's our ability to use tools, they say. Well, the thing is, if you've ever sneezed or had diarrhea, you've been used as a tool by the amoeba or virus or bacteria who caused you to sneeze or to have diarrhea, because that's how they made you do that, so that you would spread their babies around. And so those are just a couple of examples that I use to show that it's really, they're all just different excuses for us to pretend we're superior. You know, you could say, well, gosh, I'm superior because I've written all these books and I've got this radio program. And then an engineer could say, well, they're superior because they build a dam. And we all, and where I ultimately go to with all this is that, A, these are all bogus, and B, cross-species measures of intelligence and supremacy are all kind of stupid, because the real point is, I mean, humans build dams, great, some humans build dams, but beavers build dams, and beaver dams are the most biodiverse, some of the most biodiverse habitat in the world, and human dams kill rivers, so who's the more intelligent? And I go through many things like that. So that's sort of a very, very quick introduction to the book.
Good. Now let's take a look at another area. I understand that you have been critical of the scientific community now labeling the age we live in as the Anthropocene, which implies that we are now living in the age of man or humanity, and that humanity has reached a kind of ascension above everything else. Why should this term threaten us the natural world, and how might we perceive this age we live in differently?
Well, you know, it's very clear from just our communications and from your writing and from everything else that you're very psychologically astute. And if you run into somebody who's a narcissist, what is the worst thing that you should do in your interactions with them? The worst thing you can do is feed into their narcissism. And, you know, one of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the hills and valleys of Iraq. But prior to this culture, Iraq was cedar forest, so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. And Gilgamesh deforested that to make a great city and to make a great name for himself. And one of the things I say in the book is that Gilgamesh deforested that and made a name for himself, and now we're killing the planet. We're naming an entire geological age after ourselves. That's just feeding this narcissism that is... I mean, there are a lot of environmentalists... Sorry, that's not true. There are a lot of anti-environmentalists. It's called neo-environmentalism, who say, well, basically, you know, we're running the whole Earth anyway, so we just should just acknowledge that we're doing it. But that's not true. The word is that we're ruining the whole Earth. And when we try to manage... When we try to manage the oceans, I mean, here's the thing. Can you or any of your listeners name any single biome on this planet that has been managed by human supremacists that has not been harmed by that management? And there's no. It's like, would you trust a doctor that every single one of their patients died? Or would you trust a detective that every single one of their cases they investigated, they were not able to find the perpetrator? It's just... It's crazy. For 6,000 years, this culture has been, quote, managing, end quote, biomes around the world, and they've all been getting killed. And it's crazy to suggest that this suggests that we can run the planet. I would say that we need to start with some humility. And also, I would suggest that, you know, sociopathy is really one of the definitions of it, is that you don't perceive others as beings. You perceive them as items to be used. You perceive them as nothing compared to you, and you can destroy them if you wish. And this really is more the age of the sociopath than it is the age of humanity. And I'll say something else about this in a second. And so I would say this is actually the sociopocene rather than the Anthropocene. And it's the age of the sociopath. And I want to also say another problem I have with naming it the Anthropocene is that not all cultures have done this. I'm standing right now on Talawa land, Talawa Indian land, T-O-L-O-W-A. And the Talawa, according to carbon dating, they've lived here for at least 12,500 years. And according to Talawa, they've lived since the beginning of time, but it doesn't really matter. They've lived here a long, long time. And when the Europeans arrived here, the place was a paradise. The Klamath River was black and roiling with fish. There were so many fish. And Klamath is quite a big river. It's the fourth biggest river, I think, on the West Coast. Third or fourth biggest on the West Coast of the United States. Columbia, Colorado, maybe the Sacramento is bigger. I'm not sure. Anyway, it's a huge river. And there are descriptions of it being, quote, filled with fish. And now the Klamath salmon are in big trouble. And it's only been 100 years, 150 years. And the point is that we can't really call it the Anthropocene, because that's making it so what this culture does is representative of what all cultures have done, what all, quote, man have done. And that's another problem with declaring, you know, the creation of refrigerators as a sign of our superiority. Is what does that mean about the humans who have not made refrigerators? The Talawa didn't invent refrigerators. They recognized that the best way to keep salmon meat fresh is to keep it in the river. You know, that's a much better way to have fresh fish than to freeze it, put it in a freezer. And they recognized that they could live here, but they would not live here and plan on overrunning the whole place, but instead figure out what their role is, figure out how to live here, and how to live here without harming the place. And that leads to an entirely different set of actions leading from that different motivation. I mean, really what the whole book is about, and really what all my work is about, is the realization by R.D. Lang, the psychiatrist in the 60s and 70s, that people behave according to how they experience the world. And we are taught in this culture to experience the world as consisting of everyone else who's inferior to us, and we can do whatever we like with them. And there are other ways to be in the world, and those other ways are not maladaptive. This way is clearly maladaptive because it's destroying the world around us. And we've had thousands of years of living by the message, go forth and conquer, you know, go forth and multiply, to subdue the earth, to that God looks like us, as opposed to God looking like a tree, or like an aardvark, or like a river, or like everything that is, or, you know, the term, quote, G-O-D, end quote, simply being, life, simply being everything. And instead, you know, God's a white guy with a beard. And that is a powerful, powerful motivator to, not motivator, but a powerful creator of a mindset and a motivator that if you create this God that then tells you that you're better than everybody else and you get to wander around doing whatever you want with no consequences, well, then that's what you're going to do.
The myth that only humans and maybe some animal species such as primates are endowed with self-awareness and self-knowledge. Now, this is something all of us are taught in grammar school or high school or biology class. And it is an assumption that persists beyond scientific scrutiny. We call this the anthropomorphism, which is the view of life that many have. And it's erroneous, especially in light of the large body of scientific research that has been conducted, shows that humans are not alone in being endowed with self-awareness and intelligence. And then what does this say about the fallacy of our definition of self-awareness and intelligence? Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Derek, a very important issue that you touched upon, but I want to go further with it. There are several defining characteristics of a sociopath or a psychopath. And one is an incapacity to feel remorse over a crime, or after having been the cause of immense suffering upon another, to feel anything. In fact, frequently, sociopaths will cause a problem, blame the victim, and then ask the victim to apologize. We see this in personal relationships all the time. And in fact, there are millions of people listening throughout the world who would tell you, I ended up being abused, verbally abused, or physically abused, or both, but the person never took responsibility for it. Somehow, I was always blamed for what they hated about themselves and projected upon me. Sociopaths can do that not just to individuals, but whole nations, whole groups, whole classes, whole ethnicities. They're very capable of that. Now, including almost all, in my personal opinion, all the presidents of the United States clear back through FDR, including Harry Truman, who bombed unnecessarily so the people of Japan in two major bombs, killing over 150,000 people, without even having a qualm about it. They can always justify their actions. So would you address the idea that where else do we see this nature except in ourselves? And then how do you respond to that? How do you respond to this whole thing? Because we live in an age where everyone wants to label something, and yet we have common traits every day in people in the media, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, and many people on the left, especially on radio and television, that I consider sociopathic. And yet we destroy millions of species over the millennia in the name of capitalist growth and expansion. And at the same time, corporations and individuals and our government and banks and our educational institutions and the media all view this as being virtuous and necessary for civilization to sustain itself. Why is this a dangerous view? And go further into the sociopathic nature behind the idea of human supremacy over the planet.
Well, once again, a fabulous question. And I don't, you know, you mentioned feeling regret or not feeling regret. Sociopaths don't feel regret for what the harm they've caused. And how much regret has this culture shown for wiping out the passenger pigeons? There were six times as many passenger pigeons as every other bird combined in North America. How much regret have they shown for wiping out the great auks, A-U-K? That's why there are no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere. They're called great auks. Why have they shown no regret for wiping out the Eskimo curlews? The cod, the only regret that is shown by this culture for wiping out the cod is that they can't continue to exploit them. And that's the only regret I ever see by members of this culture in general over wiping out any species whatsoever, is they have foreclosed the opportunity to exploit it in the future. And that's enshrined in our very economic system. You know, I was on a panel a couple years ago with a couple other people about capitalism and sociopathology, and we had a pretty fundamental disagreement on the panel that, and it was a fun disagreement, that the other people on the panel pretty much thought that capitalism creates sociopaths, that capitalism leads to sociopathological behavior. And of course, I agree with that. But my fundamental argument was that in order to create an economic system like that, you have to be a sociopath in the first place, and that it takes a sociopath to conceptualize and implement such a community-destroying system, and such a system based on greed and a limited version of self-interest, a very limited version of self-interest, and a self-interest that's based on the lack of relationships. And so I think that this culture it's not quite so important to me what the origins of it were. We can talk about that if you want. But what's important to me is it's not so important, because right now it's like there's an axe murderer killing all members of your family. And great, we can discuss, you know, what happened in this axe murderer's childhood to make this axe murderer an axe murderer. But right now, let's stop the murders, okay? And right now, this culture is just laying waste to the planet. And so we can talk about origins, but what's really interesting to me is naming it as you just did, naming this as sociopathological, and then moving from there. And another thing I want to mention is we've all heard of the Milgram experiment, where people were brought in and they are told that they're being teachers and they're teaching other people how to learn. And there's a person in another room, and the person participating in the experiment thinks that every time the other person gets an answer wrong, they are giving them a shock. And as it goes on, the person in a white coat encourages them, the authority figure encourages them to give greater and greater shocks until some people think they might kill the person. And a significant portion, I believe a majority, but if not a majority, then close to that, of people went through to the very end, shocking this other person. And there's a really interesting thing, is they've attempted to do those same experiments with both rats and with rhesus monkeys, where they would, you know, there's constantly, they have, you know, rats have to press a lever in order to get food, but they added something to it, which is the rat would press a lever, giving it food, but at the same time, as soon as it pressed the lever, it would shock another rat. First off, what sort of sadist would come up with that sort of experiment in the first place? Now, leaving that aside, what they found is for both the rats and the rhesus monkeys, they would rather starve than shock their comrades, that they refused to participate in that experiment. And what does that say about our enculturation, our process of what does it say about what this culture has turned us into, that rats and rhesus monkeys will refuse to shock their comrades in order to get food, and we would do it just because somebody tells us to? That's really, really scary to me.
Well, that reminds me of something that I've been witnessing. I've been witnessing a great many people in the younger generation, not all, but a great many, the majority, who seem to have accepted the notion that they are not just exceptional, but they are so unique that they have no responsibility for the planet, for society, even for their own parents. I recently just counseled someone, just this last few days, who is extremely stressed, can't sleep, suffering from physical problems because they ended up signing on their son's college applications for loans. The son came out, didn't find a job in the area that he was trained in, but instead of going to work to do anything else, doesn't want to. He stays home at day, twitters with people, doesn't pay rent, doesn't pay for the food, and doesn't care that his mother is out there having to work extra and has the burden of now paying his debt. And I asked her, and I won't know the answer till she comes back, and I want to see this. I said, ask your son if he's ever heard of Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway was one of the great Lost Generation expats, and he won a Nobel Prize. He wrote Farewell to Arms, Sun Also Rises, For Whom the Bell Tolls, No Man in the Sea, and A Movable Feast, among other books. Or John Steinbeck, who won a Nobel Prize. And John Steinbeck's work was so touching to me because he talked about the plight of the downtrodden and fate and injustice. He wrote The Dubious Battle and East of Eden and Mice of Men and Grapes of Wrath. Or Thomas Wolfe, who had a very short life. He only lived, I think, to be 38, who reflected on life and values of people in the 1920s, which were different than values in the 30s. So when he walked as a very successful, America's most successful author at one time, down streets where there were poor people, he cried. He said, this is gross injustice. How can I feel good about my success and what I can eat and drink and where I can live when there are all these people waiting in a bread line? He wrote Look Homeward, Angel, and Of Time of the and the River and The Lost Boy. And then F. Scott Fitzgerald, who was a paradigmatic writer of the Jazz Age, who wrote about The Great Gatsby and This Side of Paradise and The Beautiful and the Damned and Tenors of the Night, or the great, great Jack London, who came before them, who wrote The Call of the Wild and The White Fang, The Sea Wolf and The Iron Heel, who was a social activist, who cared about people and put his care into books, as did Upton St. Clair, who wrote The Jungle and The Brass Check and King Cole, or William Faulkner, who won a Nobel Prize, also was a great Southern writer, but he wrote about Sound of Fury and The Light in August. What all these people had in common was they were all great writers, they were all great thinkers, and through their perceptions of life, we get to see society in a different view. Now, what is the biggest selling book in the United States, in fact, in the world in the last 5 years? 50 Shades of Grey. And more people have read that than all the author's books that I just mentioned combined. And yet, a young person is more likely to read 50 Shades of Grey and understand it and its sadomasochistic qualities and hedonistic qualities than people who wrote on issues that empowered other people or gave hope to other people. Final thought on that, please.
Well, something that frightens me very much is that there was a study done in 2010 of college students who, between 1980 and 2010, they would ask college students questions having to do with empathy. Simple questions like, do you feel bad when your friend suffers? Or, you know, if you had a meal and your friend is sitting there, would you give your friend some food? Some really basic questions. And what they have found, they were attempting to quantify empathy, and we can certainly discuss whether you can quantify empathy, but leave that aside for a moment. And what they found is that basically it has dropped dramatically between 1980 and 2010, and especially between 2000 and 2010, it's gone through the floor. That at the same time, another study has shown that narcissism among college students has gone up similarly. And we can talk, and maybe we should talk another time about the role of the internet in doing that, and also the role of the collapse of empire as empire collapses. Is this what happens at the end of empire?
Well, before you have a collapse of empire, you have a collapse of integrity, moral values, spiritual connections, reverence for all life, and an anti-intellectual perspective of life. That's how you create a whole new generation of narcissists. I'm going to ask you to hold
totally
on, Derek, because we want to go over to Ontario because we now have Diana on the line. Nice to have you with us today, Diana.
Hello.
Thank you for being with us.
You're very welcome, Gary.
I gave your bio at the beginning of the program.
Mm-hmm.
Diane.
Yes?
We've been speaking with Derek Jensen about the myth of human supremacy and how this myth has been ravaging the earth and is now threatening not only millions of species, but even ourselves with extinction. No other species ever created on this earth would be so suicidal, and yet we consider this trajectory towards our demise and damnation as progress, as something to applaud, as long as there is profit at hand to continue the charade of our civilized human preeminence, then extinction creeps closer towards us. So, before we look at ways to free our brains and hearts from the colonizers of this myth, which is all of our private and public institutions, educational institutions, media, government.
Yeah.
Please explain to us what the myth of human supremacy means to you, and how would you frame its detrimental consequences we face today?
I think the timeline of looking at human supremacy right at the moment and how you're speaking is too short. You take the pattern of the human being and plop them into 1930, when food was in short supply in North America. And you have a phenomenon that happens where people do have empathy with one another, and narcissism goes out the door. And what we have right now in all of the Western society, we have the phenomenon of the Internet. In my opinion, the Internet does something very strange to people. It stops them from the feelings of mysticism that you get when you walk into a forest, when you look at a tidal bore, when you look at the ocean, when you're actually alone. You have to face yourself, and you have to look at yourself. All writers really have that, all good writers. No, not, we're not talking about rubbish books here. We're talking about quality books. They face themselves, and in facing themselves, they can write. And in writing, they expand the human mind. And in the expansion of the human mind, there is some degree of supremacy in some ways. But we are always part of nature. And what you were talking about is really the perfect storm coming. And the perfect storm is in the future. And actually, Gary, you know that it's coming very close. We have so many things coming to a pinpoint for all of us that, in a way, I think the dance of the human is over. And I think we will have to settle down. And we will have to learn to love one another and love nature again. It's going to be a hard, hard lesson.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you, Diana. It's extremely difficult for the average person to perceive plants or trees as being sentient. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, the Mid-Eastern prophet of sorts, Mani, who mm-hmm. was the founder of the 2nd century CE religion, Manichaean, has
yeah.
this revelation by hearing the emotional screams of yeast and bread
yeah.
being baked in the ovens.
Mm-hmm.
And other religions at the time, even precursors of the Temple Judaism and Christianity, had a highly evolved respect for the
yeah.
sentience permeating the natural world that is similar to the indigenous people today. But today we have scientific findings, many of
yeah.
which originate with your own research,
yeah.
that reveals the intelligence in plants
yes.
and those that are analogous to the characteristics we endow ourselves with. So how would you convince someone about the sentience and awareness of a tree?
Well, it's fairly simple, really. Within the genome of a tree, you look for the pattern, the same pattern as the human genome, and it's right there in front of you, except the genome of a tree is larger than a human genome. And when you look at a tree, we do not understand even how water is pumped up 30 stories into the top of a tree. We don't understand how a tree affects the climate, or how a tree affects the water and the aquifers, how it farms the sun, how it even gathers photons into the chlorophyll, and there's a tick-tock change just like hemoglobin. We don't even understand those things. And yet we call them, you know, inanimate objects. They're far from being inanimate objects. Why is there so much serotonin in a tree? Why is there so much acetylcholine? Let's look at all of the brain tissue. It's right there in the tree, but it's also in the cambium, spread almost like a fine brain throughout the whole of the tree. Now, if I were a child, a little child, and I were to look at a tree, there are very, very few children look at a tree and think that a tree is an inanimate object. They know the tree has a life. even though the child hasn't been told about it. They know it instinctively that the tree is their friend. And in fact, you know, Gary, in the Celtic culture, in all of the Celtic world, which was an enormous world once upon a time, larger than America, really, and that was, you know, around the time of Christ, the tree was a sacred object. The first language, real language of the Western world was based on the tree, and that's the Ogham script. And it is called Ogma writing, on Ogham Creav. And the script is the script basis of the language we are using right now. And the Druids thought that the trees, believed that the trees were real and breathing and thinking and respiring creatures. They were sacred things on the landscape. But you see, then what happened is Rome does as the Romans do. And the Romans put a dollar value on nature. And that's where the crux has happened in the last 2,000 years for all of us, including America. And in America, of course, you've have the idea of the more money you have, the greater you are. The more millionaire you are, the more billionaire, trillionaire you are, the greater you are. Well, that's just really rubbish, folks, because the person with the greatest heart and the largest amount of compassion is far greater as a human being than all of that, because they have the triad, the body, the mind, and the soul. Look after your body, but take care of your mind, and for God's sake, don't lose your soul. They're the only three things that need to be said in America right now, I think, to lots of people.
Diana, why is it so difficult for humans to perceive natural beauty in such a way that the life of another species, aside from perhaps our pet cat and dog, becomes an intimate familiar to us that can trigger an expansion of our consciousness to desire to live in harmony with nature rather than as an adversary that needs to subdue it and enslave it to our needs?
Pain. There is one answer, it's just pain. People need to feel pain. And in feeling pain in your own body, you feel empathy. I mean, it's just really that simple. And as a matter of fact, I think what has happened in the schooling system is that, and the schools of really all of North America, is that the children do feel empathy, but it's kind of washed out of their minds. And they go into their homes and they see rubbish on the television and they listen to rubbish. They're not expected to quote poetry. They're not expected to feel the finer things and to see beauty. So we're washing our children's minds free of all of these things. And I think it's a very bad idea.
One of your areas of particular focus is the medicinal properties of plants and trees. Mm-hmm. And of course, animals have an innate knowledge about certain plants or minerals they search for when they're ill, just as ethnobotanists do when looking for an alkaloid in plants that might have medicinal properties for treating human illness. Mm-hmm. So if plants can treat and heal us, then what does this say about our inner relationship with the plant kingdom that we are ignoring?
Oh, you know, Gary, that's a huge thing. That's an enormous thing, where we are losing our biodiversity, where in North America we're losing all of the major medicinal plants. And in fact, you know, over and above that, there's even a nastier, more alarming thing, in that I had one of the chiefs of the First Nations come to me last year, and here in Canada I'm known as the medicine woman. And he was looking for a medicine, and it needed, the medicine for this Cree lady needed a four-point medicine, north, south, east, and west. And he said, "Diana, I can't collect the medicines from the fields around me." And I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because they've had pesticides on them." And I never, ever thought of that. So he came here. Are we lost?
No, we're here.
He came here. He said, "You're the only one who's got an organic garden." So I gave him his medicines. But I didn't realize what we were doing to the First Nations and to ourselves. You know, the medicines that we are going to need in the future are already around us. And they're not just medicines going into your mouth every day for what you need in your own body. It's a tremendous noise on the line, Gary.
I'm sorry, please continue.
Okay.
I don't hear it.
You don't hear it? Okay.
No.
Anyway, the medicines have to be there for the insect world. They have to be there for the mammalian world. They have to be there for the birds. Like, for instance, today in the garden, I have all kinds of songbirds taking dust baths. And they know what to do. But we have stopped observing nature. We have stopped being the observer and really the custodian of nature. And what's happening now is that we're losing so many things. But I believe and I know as a fact that the young people are listening to a different song of the earth. The young people are very different right now. And they are actually being critical of what's happening. They're actually going in a different direction. And the prophecies of the First Nations are that this will happen. And I see it happening. They are tremendous, wonderful young people. Okay, there are some exceptions. But for the most part, the young people have got their eyes on the ball. And the ball for them is habitat, humanity, and it is for planet Earth.
Diana, my last question for you is more philosophical.
Yes.
Would you please speak about the institution of science and how in so many regards it is failing us in further perpetrating this myth of human supremacy? For example, artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And people are saying, yeah. Great, if something can be done that I don't have to do it, without asking, what are the consequences if it doesn't work? Just like genetic engineering that goes wild, or using antibiotics in animal feed to where we no longer have the ability to resist many of these superbugs.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not asking these deeper questions. We're not standing up and looking at the entire world we live in and say, where's all this going? Where are there solutions outside of the so-called human technological solutions?
Mm-hmm.
Your final thoughts, please.
My final thought is that science is a belief system. Just like your child may think and believe in Santa at Christmas time, it essentially is a belief system based on theories, the theories of what will happen and what won't happen. But what gives me great glee is that, for instance, right now at CERN in Geneva, they're just finding something that they have thought would never happen. Something like the Higgs boson is being bombarded with neutrinos, and they're finding that the Higgs boson is actually dividing itself, well, not quite the Higgs boson, is dividing itself into subparticles, somewhat like a Russian doll, where you take one piece out of another piece out of another piece, and the end product of it is two photons. And they had never thought that this could be true. They had no idea that this could happen. Now, the Hadron is in an enormous place. CERN is an enormously expensive place. So in some senses, I look at this and I think, we really need to sit back. We really need to rethink some of the GMO attitudes. We really need to think about quantum mechanics and the singularity of species. We need to think. But you know, Gary, only 2% of the population have had any training in science. So it's up to people like you and I to thread these ideas out for the public and to actually stand in public debate about it, because people don't know. They're being led by the nose to the trough, and they think at the end of it there's the glory of greed and food and everything. There isn't. Science is just in a pattern language, just like religion is. And they don't have the answers like the rest of us don't have the answers. It's the best death on everything. So what we need are critical thinkers. We need people in dialogue, we need people in discussion, and we need some training within the media of critical thinkers. And then we can have some really good discussions about the things that are happening all around us.
I appreciate your insights, Diana. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome, Gary.
Diana Birchford Kroger, and also Derek Jensen. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.